I'm Rebecca Ibarra, host of WNYC and NPR's Consider This, in for Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. The COVID-19 pandemic has devastated the U.S. labor market over the past year, but there's a workforce especially vulnerable and largely unseen during this economic downturn: domestic workers.
Domestic workers cover nannies, house cleaners, and home care workers, basically anyone who works in the private home setting, providing caregiving or cleaning services.
That's Ai-Jen Poo.
And I'm the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and Caring Across Generations.
She says there's an estimated 2.5 million domestic workers in the U.S., the majority of whom are women of color and immigrants. Many domestic workers say they've lost their jobs because of the pandemic, and they've also had to weigh the health and safety risks associated with actually going to work. They often lack the same access to personal protective equipment that other frontline workers have. We spoke with Ai-Jen Poo about the pandemic's toll on domestic workers and what it's meant for how we think about this workforce.
It's a workforce that we rarely think about, and I think in the pandemic has become seen as more essential, as more and more families are just really struggling with their caregiving challenges, whether it's childcare or children home from school, or parents in nursing homes that have been ravaged by the COVID virus, having to kind of figure out alternative options. And meanwhile, we are in a situation where even before the pandemic, we actually had a shortage of workers in home care because the wages were so low for this workforce that people couldn't sustain doing this work. The average annual wage for a home care worker in America is $17,000 per year.
People often think about childcare in this context, but a large portion of these jobs are actually in elder care, right?
That's right. Our caregivers provide caregiving services across the lifespan. So there are nannies, but there are also home care workers, like the essential workers who've been working on the front lines through the pandemic, providing a lifeline to our elders and people with disabilities who are living in their homes. And oftentimes they're the only human contact that people have in the pandemic. These are some of the populations that are most vulnerable to the COVID virus itself. So it's just been, it's been really essential that the home care workers are out there making sure our loved ones are safe.
Do we know why this workforce is made mostly of women of color and immigrants?
The work itself of caregiving has always been associated with women and kind of assumed or taken for granted that women will do this work. But the truth of it is in this country, we don't have any kind of real care infrastructure. We just assume, we take it for granted that women will figure it out. And what we do have is this invisible workforce of mostly women of color who do this work as a profession, but are so undervalued and unseen in our economy. It's this deep irony that the people that we're counting on to take care of us and our families can't take care of their own doing this work. And it's always been the case. As a profession, domestic work has always been associated with Black women and women of color, immigrant women of color. And in the 1930s, when our nation's labor laws were put into place, Southern members of Congress would not support the labor laws that were a part of the New Deal if they included protections for domestic workers and also farm workers, both groups of workers who were mostly Black at the time. That racial exclusion has basically shaped the way that we've protected or failed to protect this workforce throughout our history. And it has remained one that has really been one of the main sources of income and jobs for many women of color throughout the history of this country. And we have not yet taken the big leap to value it for the true significance it plays in our economy and in our families. And I think that coming out of this pandemic, as we think about what it looks like to recover, to truly have an economic recovery that lifts up the people who've been directly impacted and impacted the hardest, that we have to put these care workers and our caregiving families front and center in our solutions.
What has the COVID-19 pandemic meant for these workers financially? Have they seen major job losses?
Immediately as the stay-at-home orders came down, there were dramatic losses in jobs and income. I remember in the second week of the stay-at-home orders, we had a Zoom call with some of our members, and one of our members held up her phone to the camera to show us that there was literally 1 cent left in her bank account. And that was a year ago. By definition, this is work that has to be done in person, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. You're immediately caught in an impossible choice between putting food on the table and keeping yourself and your family safe. And for those who continued to work as essential workers, they were paying out of pocket for safer modes of transportation to and from work to minimize exposure, paying out of pocket for PPE, didn't have sick days, didn't have hazard pay, didn't have health care.
In addition to that economic impact, domestic workers have also had to worry about their physical health, given the risk of exposure on the job. What can you tell us about that? What safety concerns have been top of mind?
Making sure that you are keeping yourself safe and that you are walking into safe environments as you do your work. Meanwhile, making sure that your children who are home from school and trying to navigate online learning have the care and support that they need. It's been a real challenge. And 80% of domestic workers came into the pandemic without a single paid sick day. There hasn't been a real access to the kind of safety net that would assist this workforce in keeping themselves safe and healthy through a pandemic like this one.
And why are domestic workers so often denied basic workplace protections? You know, protection from harassment, benefits like healthcare, you know, minimum wage laws.
I think that we culturally still have not adequately recognized and valued this work as real work. We still treat it as less than a real profession. And I think it's partly because the work itself has been associated with women and also because of who does it, right? Black and brown women, immigrant women who are also devalued in our society and in our culture. We still refer to this profession as help. When it is a full-time job for millions of workers and millions of families rely upon the income of our caregiving professionals and our domestic workers who do this work. And it is such valuable work. What could be more valuable than uplifting and upholding the dignity of our elders as they age and become more fragile? Making sure that people with disabilities have the ability to live independently in their communities and live full, dignified lives, or nurturing the human potential of a child. These roles are absolutely essential, and I would even say fundamental infrastructure, right? We usually think about infrastructure as bricks and mortar, bridges, tunnels, broadband. And now that we're talking about economic recovery, there's a lot of talk about infrastructure. But this is essential infrastructure. It is care that makes all other work possible. And it's part of the reason why we're hemorrhaging women from the workforce right now, because they are grappling, struggling to figure out how to manage care without an adequate care infrastructure in this country. And it's everyone from parents to daughters and sons of aging loved ones who need support.
What kind of protections have we seen put in place for domestic workers since the pandemic started, and what else is needed?
I have to say, Rebecca, that I don't have good news to report about what has been put into place in the pandemic. Actually, not very much. And even some of the federal relief that has been made available has not reached most domestic workers because of their immigration status or because they work in a cash economy and are non-traditional workers. So even the minimum relief that has been available has not reached domestic workers. And we just did a survey of domestic workers around the country and found that it is at a 40% unemployment rate. And so it's a full-blown depression. It's not hyperbole. It is a full-blown depression. And we need protections. We need better wages. We need sick days, paid leave. We need a big investment in our caregiving programs, putting money into the Medicaid system so that we can raise wages for the home care workforce, putting money into our child care systems. These are all essential steps that we need to take to address the incredible struggles that this workforce of women are facing every day. And it's a huge opportunity because it means that if we have a strong care infrastructure in this country, that is going to enable everybody else to get back to work. Hmm. Care jobs are job-enabling jobs, right? They not only benefit the workers and their families, but they make it possible for all of us to work knowing that the most important aspects of our lives, our loved ones, and our homes are in good hands.
Politically, is this an issue that gets support at all from both sides of the partisan divide, or has caregiving also become politicized?
Caregiving is a universally supported issue across Democratic and Republican voters across the country. Over 70% of Republican voters support big public investments in our caregiving systems to support our caregivers and to expand access to services that people urgently need. Everyone has a care story. Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter used to say, she has a famous saying, that there are only four kinds of people in the world: people who are caregivers or will be caregivers, people who need care or will need care. And I think that people understand that more than ever before coming out of this pandemic. It has helped us see that this is not something that is just a personal burden and responsibility. And if we can't figure it out, it's because we failed or we did something wrong. We actually need infrastructure and programs and public policies to support our ability to take care of our families while we're working. It's just a simple awakening and realization that has been catalyzed by this pandemic that is frankly long overdue and I think has to be central in how we think about economic recovery.
Ai-Jen Poo is the co-founder and executive director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and the director of Caring Across Generations. Ai-Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rebecca.
Are you a domestic worker? What has the pandemic meant for your financial situation and your health? Tell us about your experience by sending a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com or by calling 877-869-8253. Recently, the House of Representatives passed the Equality Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. And while President Biden has voiced his support for the bill, it will need 60 votes in the Senate. But across the country, there are more than 70 anti-trans bills pending in state legislatures. At the same time, a new coalition called A Promise to America's Children is drafting model legislation for keeping trans kids from participating in sports and receiving medical care. The coalition includes organizations like the Alliance Defending Freedom, which has been designated as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Conservative groups, including the Heritage Foundation and the Family Policy Alliance, are also involved. With us to talk about why we're seeing this renewed push for anti-trans legislation is Kate Sausson, LGBTQ plus reporter at The 19th, a nonprofit newsroom reporting on gender, politics, and policy. Kate, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a bit more about this coalition pushing anti-trans legislation? What kinds of groups are part of it?
Yeah, this is a made up of anti-LGBTQ organizations that are both national and local to states. And they've been involved in pushing this legislation for years now, but it's the first time that we've seen them very sort of take up this so boldly and offer to write model legislation via an online form. So they have a website and you can go on as if you were going to join a mailing list and say, I'm from this district and this is the kind of bill that I want. Please send me an anti-trans sports bill. To give you a sense of who the Alliance Defending Freedom is, they have argued for the forced sterilization of transgender people in the European Court of Human Rights. They have repeatedly called gay people pedophiles. They're kind of the farthest extreme in terms of anti-LGBTQ stance that you can get, which is why they have been labeled a hate group.
Kate, describe what the model legislation aims to do.
Yeah, so we're looking at two main bills this year in terms of regulating transgender children. One is a transgender medical ban. So this would prevent transgender children from accessing the care that the medical community has deemed necessary for trans kids. And that's mostly what we call puberty blockers. So if you're a transgender child, a lot of times you'll go to your doctor and they'll say, look, you're not old enough to know if you want to transition medically or not, but if you go through puberty, you're probably going to experience severe mental duress. So we'll give you a puberty blocker. It just pauses puberty until you're old enough to decide with your parents, with your medical providers, if you want to medically transition. And this would make that illegal for kids to obtain puberty blockers. The other bill that we're seeing, of course, is which are getting a lot of attention, are these trans sports bills, which target particularly trans girls who want to play on their scholastic teams with other girls, which basically categorize them as males and then prevent them from playing sports.
Another goal of this coalition is to fight the Equality Act. Can you explain some of the specifics of the Equality Act and where it stands in Congress?
So the Equality Act is the most substantial LGBTQ civil rights legislation that we've ever seen. I think a lot of us aren't aware of the fact that in most states, it's still legal to discriminate against an LGBTQ person. You can deny service to someone because they're gay or transgender. You can tell them that they can't rent an apartment, or you can deny them services. And we think that because it's wrong, right? Like, just intrinsically, we know that. But these protections haven't been passed in most states. The Equality Act sort of takes this patchwork of protections that states and cities have passed and sews them all together. And so they're opposed to the Equality Act. A lot of them say because there are not enough religious exemptions. Now, the issue with this is what the Equality Act does is it looks at other civil rights legislation, which protects people of color, immigrants, and it extends those protections to LGBTQ people. Mm-hmm. When we think about religious exemptions, we don't have a religious exemption that says my deeply held religious faith makes it okay for me to turn away a Black person seeking service in a restaurant. And so LGBTQ advocates and some of these religious conservative groups are really going to hit a sticking point on this. Because does your sincerely held religious belief make it okay for you to turn away an LGBTQ person the way that you would not be able to another protected class?
Has there been any national polling around support for legislation like the Equality Act?
Yes, there has been a number of polls, and overwhelmingly, people support it time and again. And this is not just progressive people; it's also conservative people. The country seems to really have an appetite for this, and that seems to be because, one, we already think that this is law, right? Most of us think that it's illegal to fire an LGBTQ person, to turn away someone from services because they are LGBTQ. And most of us at this point know a gay person, a transgender person, a bisexual person. We have queer people in our families. And so, you know, among most of us in the country, this is sort of non-controversial. It gets controversial when we take it into policy.
Kate, compared to past years, how does this year look so far in terms of anti-trans and anti-LGBTQ bills?
So this year is on track to be the what LGBTQ advocates say is the worst year in terms of bills filed against LGBTQ people. 2020, there were more than 200 anti-LGBTQ bills filed, and that was what was called a banner year for anti-LGBTQ legislation, and the pandemic actually halted those bills by closing state houses. The Human Rights Campaign reported yesterday that they think within the week we will eclipse that number with more bills being filed every single day.
And have any states successfully passed these types of bills in the past?
Yes. Last year, Idaho actually passed two anti-trans bills. One was a ban on birth certificates, transgender people being able to update their birth certificates, and an anti-trans sports bill. The courts blocked both of them. One, the birth certificate bill, actually Lambda Legal, an LGBTQ legal organization, had already litigated that, so a judge threw it out. And then the sports bill, a judge found it unconstitutional and has blocked that from going into effect. The feeling overwhelmingly actually is that these bills legally don't have a lot of ground. The country is changing. The courts are changing. And in June of last year, the Supreme Court ruled that current civil rights law actually makes it illegal to fire someone because they are LGBTQ, and that laid a groundwork that a lot of people think is going to extend to protections for LGBTQ people in all areas of life and might undercut a lot of these bills.
But Kate, does this kind of legislation have impacts even if it fails to pass?
There are two impacts. One is that we have a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court. And so a flood of these bills, if one of these bills hits the right circuit and gets elevated, which is for sure a strategy, it seems like these groups and these lawmakers feel like they might have a real chance of actually changing the law. And we've seen, you know, justices on the Supreme Court have said that they have an interest in overturning marriage equality. So there does seem to be an appetite at the Supreme Court to take up some of these issues. And then the other piece of this is raising a legitimate question about the dignity and humanity of trans people. You know, South Dakota has been the testing ground for a lot of these bills. And I went to South Dakota last January when a trans medical ban was being considered. And I interviewed the children there who were being asked to testify. And the 16-year-old trans kid just told me, he said, "I wish that I wasn't trans." He said, "I don't actually want to do this. I just want to be a teenager." And I think when we're talking about these bills, we're thinking about them in a big picture way about transgender rights and history and the arc of the country. But we don't often consider, when we're debating these things, we're actually asking children to go to their lawmakers and ask for really basic things like healthcare or the ability to participate in after-school activities. And the message that they're getting back from lawmakers is, "We wish you weren't who you are."
Finally, Kate, last week, confirmation hearings were held for Rachel Levine, President Biden's nominee for Assistant Secretary of Health. Levine would be the first openly transgender federal official confirmed by the Senate. So what does her appointment mean for transgender rights nationwide?
Dr. Levine's appointment would be incredibly significant for a lot of transgender people, most especially because it's to HHS. You know, over the last 4 years, a lot of what we're seeing as attacks on transgender people happened in HHS. So healthcare in particular became really fraught for transgender people, and the rulemaking changes in regards to the Affordable Care Act, the anti-discrimination protections for transgender people happened at HHS. A lot of the rollbacks for LGBTQ people that the Trump administration undertook happened, you know, via executive order, and the Biden administration is already rolling them back. But the most significant and sticking changes that the Trump administration overtook happened via this lengthy rulemaking process where the public had to weigh in. And those happened through HHS. And it was really seen as an agency that was weaponized against transgender people. And because healthcare is so sacred to all of us, and especially to transgender individuals, that agency really holds a lot of power. And so to send a transgender person there really put an exclamation point, I think, for a lot of people on the fact that this new administration is thinking about the needs of this community.
Kate Sausson is LGBTQ plus reporter at the 19th. Kate, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Prior to the pandemic, the United Methodist Church was on the verge of splintering over a disagreement on LGBTQ inclusivity. The more conservative branch of the church opposes same-sex marriage and ordaining LGBTQ clergy members, while a coalition of centrists and progressives wants to welcome LGBTQ people in. This week, the conservative branch of the church publicly announced more plans for their new denomination, the Global Methodist Church, and expressed a desire for the split to be voted on this May at an online conference. But church leaders say their plan is to hold the vote at the church's next in-person general conference in August of 2022. With us now to discuss is Reverend Tom Berlin, pastor at Floris UMC. Reverend Berlin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Before we get into some of the most recent developments, remind us, why was 2019 a breaking point for these tensions in the United Methodist Church?
In 2019, we held a general conference. That's our global meeting with representatives from around the world who are United Methodist. And by a very slim margin, a plan that I and others worked on called the One Church Plan was defeated. That would have allowed United Methodist churches to do different things in different places related to LGBTQ inclusion, including weddings and ordination, as you suggested earlier. Mm-hmm. Instead, we received a traditional plan, which is rather punitive to clergy who perform such marriages and would never allow an LGBTQ person to be ordained. It actually made our governing bodies more strict. And so, as you can imagine, there was a rather large backlash from that. And those that were centrist and more progressive around these issues made it known that they weren't going to leave, that they were going to stay in the church and continue to work for what they felt was a justice issue. Traditional people, by contrast, many felt that they really didn't have a victory. They understood the pain that was around them. And so at that time, people began to say, is it time for us to formally part ways?
And you were part of a group of bishops that put together a proposal formalizing this split. What did you lay out in that proposal?
The group included bishops, clergy, which is what I am, and laity. And we worked together to find ways to allow churches who wanted to leave, and even annual conferences, which is a regional body of churches, allow them to leave and join either a more traditional denomination or, on the other side, a more progressive denomination than the United Methodist Church. United Methodist churches have an unusual feature. It's called a trust clause. And that trust clause means that the congregations hold their properties in trust by the denomination. So that means the church that I'm in, physically sitting in right now, our congregation doesn't actually own. And what this protocol would allow us to do is to allow churches to take their property with them as they depart the denomination. That's what's really new here. Mm. And as you can imagine, that really matters. Having the facility that you're in makes a big difference in the life of a congregation. Mm. It allows them to do that without lawsuits. It allows them to do that peacefully. There's also a financial settlement that the new traditional church and a more progressive denomination on the other side would also be given funds to start their new life together.
And there was originally going to be a vote on the split back at the church's general conference in May of 2020, but that conference was delayed until August 2022 because of the pandemic. How was that date decided on?
We are a global body, so when our delegates gather, they come from the continents of Africa, Europe, the Philippines, the United States. It's very difficult to hold such a gathering during this pandemic because we include countries that don't have access to vaccinations at this time and probably won't anytime soon. So we're hoping that August of 2022 will work, but we don't want to disenfranchise those delegates by holding it at a time when they can't attend because of the coronavirus. The May General Conference is being held virtually, but it'll use a paper ballot, and only 12 rather simple items compared to this legislation will be considered. And those items are really just helping the wheels of the denomination continue to turn during this time. Most of us have experienced great change due to the pandemic, and so the church is not exempted from that.
Reverend, we mentioned earlier that the conservative faction of the Methodist Church announced plans this week for their new denomination, the Global Methodist Church. What did you make of that announcement?
I wasn't surprised by it. The issue of LGBTQ inclusion is a presenting issue in the United Methodist Church, and it's a really important issue. Many of us simply believe that the church is designed to be an open and inclusive place. It's designed to love our neighbor as ourself, and that includes our LGBTQ family members, friends, community members, people we know, and even people, you know, those we don't know. Others believe that if the church performs a same-sex marriage or ordains a gay person, that is incompatible with their Christian beliefs. Mm. That is, as I say, a presenting issue. It says that there's a difference in the way that we're looking at Scripture in that regard. It doesn't mean, I'm not suggesting that people that differ with me on this issue are not Christians or anything severe, but it is a difference, and it's an important difference because for many of us, the inclusion of LGBTQ people is an issue of both justice and compassion. And these are people that are vulnerable. These are people that have a long history of discrimination in our country and abuse and worse. And so we simply want a church where those people can be married, be ordained, be treated as full members. And so when the new denomination arose this week, when it was announced, it's not yet a legal entity, but they've stood up a website. I wasn't surprised by that. They have been saying for a long time that that's what they were going to do. So I think that it's been very predictable that that would happen. It is a sign, though, that even with the pandemic, this group has decided it wants to continue forward momentum. And it's the issue is important enough to them that they want to break away, and they're actively making plans to do so. Many of us during this pandemic in churches have just been trying to get food to people in our community who have food scarcity. We've been trying to figure out how to hold a worship and small groups and other things virtually. We've been trying to figure out how to care for our members and members of our community at a distance. And that's been quite a struggle. So I was also quite impressed that in the midst of all that, people were able to put up a new denomination because they felt so strongly about the issues that are at hand.
The Global Methodist Church says they're going to emphasize ethnic and racial diversity as part of their mission. Was that diversity not already a part of the United Methodist Church's mission, Reverend?
It absolutely is. And so I don't think that they are stating a new thing. I think they're attempting to say that that value will come with them. But that's been the value of the United Methodist Church. You know, we ordained women for ministry in the 1950s ahead of most denominations and churches. We have welcomed people of all races, you know, earlier than many churches. We're not a perfect denomination. If you look deeply into our history, it has the same dark spots and long shadow that most mainline churches and other congregations do. So I'm not trying to make us better than we are, but we are a global church. We are in different continents around the world. We do believe that everyone should have the same rights within our general conference. We have what are called cross-cultural appointments where, you know, churches tend to be predominantly one grouping or another, and we've been working to try to see the church become a blended, rich, and diverse space. So that statement on their website is not a reflection of a new value. It is trying to assure people, I believe, that the value that was there in the past will be there in the future. I can only assume. It's not my space, so I don't want to interpret too broadly, but I think that's what they're doing.
we've been talking about the divisions between larger factions of the Methodist Church, but how have these tensions been playing out within your own congregation?
You know, we've been working at this for some time now to have this conversation. In any church, I serve a large congregation, and I serve a congregation that is in a suburb of Washington, D.C. Within the life of our church, we have LGBTQ persons. We have members whose children are gay or transgendered. We're surrounded in our community. You know, LGBTQ people are here. they're just simply here. So it's not as though we can act as though they are not. We either have to decide openly to include and welcome and be hospitable. And people don't want simply a nod of the head. They want to know that they're fully included. They want to have voice and vote. They want to be a part of the body. And so in our church, we've been having this conversation for a few years now. We recently developed a logo, I guess it's been 2 years ago now, that we call One Church for All. That logo has a section that says all abilities, because we want people of varying abilities, disabilities to be here. It includes people of all races and ethnic backgrounds and all identities and orientations. And so the logo has three different colors that signify these things. And so we've been trying to do that very openly, have the conversation. In the course of that, we've lost a few members. We've probably lost a dozen households because of that, but we have over 1,000 people who attend. And so I feel like that's a pretty good number. And I've received appreciation. Our church has received appreciation by dozens and dozens of people who are simply so grateful that we're having the conversation, and people that are really grateful that their grandchildren who are gay are welcome. The couple that came with their two children, two women who are legally married in the state of Virginia, they've got two children. They're just looking for a church. I mean, people aren't, to my experience, people aren't looking for anything other than that. They want to know if they're going to be loved. They want to know if people will be kind to them. It's not like people are asking for the moon here. And so I'm just amazed that is an issue of incompatibility to those who would go form a new denomination. I've been working in this for a long time. I still find that startling.
And in the few seconds we have left, what are you hoping the future of the church will look like once this split is formalized?
Well, I think what we're doing is some self-definition work here. The United Methodist Church has said for years it's open hearts, open minds, and open doors, and we're putting that to the test. And I think if you have open doors, you open them to everyone and you treat everyone the same. These are, in my opinion, issues of identity and orientation. These are not, I don't think people wake up one day and say, I want to be straight, I want to be gay. I think that's something that's built into the nature of people in different ways on a broad spectrum. I think that the same way we're welcome to people of all races, we want to be welcome to all people and all abilities. So I think that this is an opportunity for us to reaffirm values. It's a time for us to build vital community. And when the pandemic's over, I am really looking forward to getting to see our people in person, because I miss that the most during this pandemic. I miss the richness. It's hard to do that at a distance. I'm sure you're feeling that same way I am. Mm-hmm. So I think I think self-definition is the work of mature humans. And I think that's what we're doing right now in the United Methodist Church.
Reverend Tom Berlin is a pastor at Floris UMC. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, your turn. You had thoughts on this.
Hello, this is Al from Salt Lake City, Utah. As a gay man, I left the Mormon Church. I lost many friends when I left, but if they really didn't like me after leaving, they probably weren't friends anyway. But being honest with myself and finding a wonderful man, I am so much happier.
Hi, my name is Danny. I'm from Rockaway, New Jersey. I don't have a faith community. I left my faith community in part because they did not embrace LGBTQ rights.
Every memory you think you have of the past,
the house you grew up in, your first kiss,
it's not simply an idea, it's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Many of us are familiar with the queen of Tejano music. Yo te di todo mi amor y más. That's Selena, the Mexican-American singer who was one of the biggest pop stars in the 90s before being killed in 1995. Now, a new podcast is exploring Selena's legacy. The podcast doesn't just focus on Selena's life, but the way she changed culture and the way we see ethnicity and race, especially Latinidad. In one of the latest episodes, the podcast explores how, in a recent TV adaptation, Selena is played by actresses who are whiter than she actually was in real life. And this brought the podcast's host to explore her own identity and self-journey with race and ethnicity. With us now is Maria Garcia, creator and host of the podcast Anything for Selena from WBUR and Futuro Studios. Maria, thank you for being here.
Rebecca, thank you so much for having me. And I love that you started with Si Una Vez.
Yes.
So such a not basic move. So many interviews I've done start with like the expected Como La Flor intro. So shout out to you. Shout out to you for going with Si Una Vez.
Love it. Love it. So why did you decide to make a podcast about Selena in 2021?
The podcast is really the culmination of my lifelong quest to understand what it was that drew me to this woman, that fascinated me about this woman. And if I looked back at these different flashpoints in my life, these formative moments that came to shape my identity, Selena was there in some form or another. It's my hope that with rigorous journalism, cultural analysis, and just really vulnerable storytelling, we can finally do her legacy justice in a way that hasn't been done.
So, Maria, in the podcast, you discuss how Selena's brownness was an integral part of her legacy. Why is that?
Because there were so few visibly brown women, women of visible indigenous ancestry, even on Latin American television in this time. This is the early and mid 90s, where even on Mexican television, even on Spanish speaking programming, most of the hosts, most of the actresses, most of the entertainers were white, light skinned, colored eyes. And so Selena came along, and there were so few entertainers who looked like her that it was just revolutionary, and it continues to be.
Let's break down episode 8. From the podcast. It's called Selena and Race. Maria, how did grappling with Selena's race lead you to confront your own identity?
So when the Selena Netflix series aired, I was like deep in a Selena trance. I knew all of the Selena internet conversations. I had been researching it forever. But what fascinated me is how much the conversation around her brownness had evolved in the last quarter century. Frankly, because our articulation of race, the language, we have much more nuanced language around race than we did when she died a quarter century ago as a society. And so it was so fascinating to me that there were these claims that she had been whitewashed in the new Netflix series with people on sort of different places in the spectrum, some saying, oh yeah, absolutely, this actress who's playing her, Christian Serratos, is much lighter than she was, and even J-Lo was lighter. It's sort of the gradual whitewashing of Selena, with other people saying, you know, Selena had melanin, but let's not pretend she was Tonantzin, the indigenous deity that the Spanish recast as the Virgin Mary. And so that got me thinking about how much the legibility, how we read her brownness, has changed. And it inevitably made me think about how the legibility of my identity, how I am read in the world, how I am perceived, how I am racialized, and the way I've thought of my identity, the way it has changed in my lifetime. So it made me look inward.
Maria, like so many Latinos, your own family comes in different shades of brown and beige and white. Tell us about your grandmother briefly and how she felt about your light complexion.
Yeah. So when I went on this journey about my own identity, one of the things that kept coming up, this memory that I had, was this story that I've been told all of my life. It's sort of family lore. And I think there's a story like this for a lot of white babies in Latin from that come from Latin American families, because mm-hmm. colorism is just so prominent, it's so mm-hmm. strong. But I remember the story of my grandmother, who clearly had indigenous and black ancestry, you know, showing me off at the hospital and telling everybody, look, I have a, I got a white granddaughter. Look at her skin. It is so
Huerita.
Huerita, yeah. And it was a nickname that stuck with me my whole life. And it made me think, I was already thinking really deeply about my grandmother, because I had read that grandmothers are the key to understanding both the trauma and the resilience that runs through your veins. Because when your mother was in your grandmother's womb, the egg that would come to make you was already inside the fetus. So my mm-hmm. grandmother is my life source. What does it mean that I come from a woman whose Black and Indigenous ancestry was never recognized, while my whiteness was immediately recognized the second I was born? And to me, it means that my family's history is still very much, and I say this in the podcast, tethered to the colonizer's caste system. And it's something that I really had to reckon with in this episode, all because of Selena.
Maria, in the 30 seconds we have left, how are listeners responding to these episodes and how they relate to their own journeys of self-exploration?
Oh my gosh, Rebecca, my inbox is flooded. My DMs are flooded, especially with women and femmes who say, I have never heard or consumed anything that reflected my experience like this, that felt like it was made to reflect my experience. And I hope that this podcast starts other people on their own journey of self-exploration.
Maria, you say that even though you are a light-skinned Mexican-American woman, you are still othered. Break that down for us, because it's much more complicated than the brown-white binary, right?
Yeah, so privilege, you know, is not binary. It's not like either you have it or you don't. You know, it's layered. There's different levels of privilege that you may have or you don't, all at the same time. So, for example, my ethnic identity as a Mexican American, as a first generation Mexican American whose experience is rooted in a very working class scene, like, I always grew up thinking that I was not white, because growing up on the border, growing up in El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, working class Mexican was oppositional to white. But again, I had to go back to my family history and the way that they recognized my whiteness. Mm. And when I was grappling with these things and talking to some of my friends, I said, you know, I don't think that I'm a woman of color. Like, I don't think that's a term that I should be using for myself because of my skin tone. Some of my friends were like, wait a minute, but you're not white, right? Like, you're not Anglo white. You're still othered in this country. What about the time, you know, your son with your skin tone was walking around with his father in Boston and somebody called him a spick? What about, you know, and you were depressed and anxious for weeks after? What about the time you were on the bus and somebody said that you were what happened when you overpaid the help? You know, you're still, you know, I can't be in a room with all sort of like Anglo white people with, especially in Boston, and not be othered. Like, I never feel fully like I can sort of let my hair down. Like, I don't have to code switch. Like, I'm completely safe when I'm around, you know, like, white people in this country. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, my ethnicity as a Mexican American, right, does not negate the privileges that my skin tone as a light-skinned woman, and now I'm comfortable saying as a white Mexican, have given me. Like, it just doesn't negate that. Sure, I face discrimination, and I have faced discrimination because of my ethnicity. I've also faced privilege, and I've also faced, you know, favoritism because of my light skinned. And if we look back at the opportunities in my life, like, I can't ignore the fact that my white skin tone grants me access to opportunities that are much harder for people with darker skin tones in a white supremacist world, regardless of my ethnicity.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how these questions of race in your own life and in the podcast connect more broadly to white supremacy.
Well, you know, in episode 4, when we talk about the cultural lineage from the obsession with Selena's body, and particularly with Selena's derriere, to today's mainstreaming of the big butt, right? How did we get there in the last quarter century as a country? How did we do a 180 on butts, where, you know, 25 years ago, it was a feature that was derided by the mainstream? Big, you know, there were workout videos to get rid of the big butt. Mm-hmm. And now it's the opposite, right? And in that episode, we really pose this idea, and we sort of connect the dots through the decades. We break it down for you, of how Latinidad, at least this latest iteration of Latino identity in the United States, how it formed and how it has been used in pop culture as a tool of white supremacy by taking aspects of Black culture. And we saw this with J-Lo's ascendance after the Selena movie. She sort of became the vanguard for this new Latino identity and Latino content. Mm-hmm. Taking aspects of Black culture and through Latino identity, making them palatable for white audiences, making them appealing to the mainstream, sort of taking out the Black from Black culture and then capitalizing on it. And so in episode 4 of the podcast, we sort of set that foundation as Latinidad, as a potential tool of white supremacy. And then later on in the podcast, in episode 8, we really sort of break that down and say, like, what does white supremacy look like in our families, in our family lines, you know, in our family histories, in the way that we racialize each other, you know? And so that's how I hope that the podcast addresses that.
Maria Garcia is a creator and host of the podcast Anything for Selena from WBUR and Futuro Studios. Maria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
All right, everyone, it's a wrap. Thank you for letting me join you, and thank you to the Takeaway team for a great week. You can always follow me at Rebe Ibarra C. My colleague Matt Katz will be here next week with you while we get ready to bring you this new 5-day-a-week Takeaway with Tanzina Vega very soon. A couple of things here at the end of the week. First off, Leslie Kaplan and Andrew Bollinger were the Takeaway listeners behind that lovely Oy Vey parody song yesterday in our journal segment. We want to thank them for that. And of course, you can always sing to us or comment on any story. Send us a voice memo at takeawaycallers@gmail.com or call us at 877-869-8253. Or if you don't like either of those options, head to thetakeaway.org and click on the Contact Us tab. Lots of options, people. We just want to hear from you. And let's thank the rock stars that make this show every week. Jackie Martin, Jose Olivares, and Ethan Oberman were our line producers this week. Our producers were Meg Dalton, Patricia Jacob, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and our senior producer is Amber Hall. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer, and Debbie Daughtry was in studio this week running the board. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill is our EP. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rebecca Ibarra from WNYC, and this is The Takeaway.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.